then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more bore for signal token, whistle up the marching tune. For your pike upon your shoulder, by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon. With your pike upon your shoulder, by the rising of the moon. From many a mud walled cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a man big chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew. And the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest Homeland, comrades. It's March the 20th, 2014. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Right, what shall we begin with this week? Not much housekeeping. Got the first bulk order of 5th edition white books in, and most of those are now in the mail to assorted deserving comrades. Tell you what, let's start with an email from a young man named Noah in California. Now, this is going to be one of those spaced repetition things, since this is a question that I keep getting in various forms. Hello, HAC. I am an 18-year-old white male currently living in Roseville, California, just north of that racial sewer better known as Sacramento. I've converted myself to National Socialism through my own relentless studying of history since around the age of 13. So don't worry, HAC, I have successfully purged my mind of all of that American liberal horseshit they pumped into my formerly cholesterol-clogged TV-watching gullible mind in a matter of just a few years of private study of the entire social, political, economic system and seeing how it affected my life personally. And then after that, everything began to make sense. Anyway, I've contacted you, HAC, for some personal advice about what I should do next. I'm currently attending a charter school and rounding up the last of my high school credits. I'm also employed in a crappy minimum wage job, saving up my money for a truck of my own. But my mother is expecting me to join the Army as soon as I graduate. So, HAC, should I join the Army of Zog? Or should I just hop on Interstate 5 as soon as I get my new truck and head for the Northwest? Okay, like I said, common problem, so let's hit this one again. Numero uno. For the record, for you and everyone like you in a similar situation, what you should not do, Noah, is simply hop in your truck the day after you graduate and head up Interstate 5 to Seattle with nothing but the t-shirt on your back and $100 in your pocket. We cannot, at this time, provide for you, take you in, give you accommodation or a job, or indeed give you anything except advice and some degree of hands-on assistance in finding things, so forth and so on. New migrants have to bring everything they need in the way of money and skills with them, or find those things off their own bat, which may be one of the reasons that people who listen to this show are so reluctant to get their asses up here where they're supposed to be. Now, I have had dozens of people down through the years tell me flat out, in various words, that once we can quote-unquote show them something, in other words, once we can give them things and trot out a finished product, then they'll come. And these people honestly see nothing wrong with that. Hey, they're 21st century Americans. Self-interest is who they are. They just don't know any other way. Now, to them, it's just common sense, and they are genuinely shocked and upset at the fact that I really do expect them to undergo risk and personal inconvenience in order to go first and then set up the safety net for those who come after. That's what we're short on right now. Not settlers, but pioneers. Now, in the old days, the two were one and the same, but not anymore. However, going first does not mean coming unprepared. Let me run this down for you, Noah. Now, I get the impression that college is not an option for you for whatever reason. Don't feel bad about that, because college is no longer an option for most white boys these days unless your parents are part of the 1%, or unless you're willing to incur tens and hundreds of thousands of dollars in student loan debt, which you can never bankrupt out of, and which is probably going to lead to a lot of people eventually going to debtor's prison or slave labor camps at some time in the future when they can no longer pay, and the dictatorship decides to use student loan defaulters as one more source of cheap labor. That's been suggested, by the way. What you need to do is to hang on to that crappy minimum wage job, find some way to sweet talk your mother into not throwing you out of the house like my own father threw me out of the house at age 17, forcing me to go into the army, and spend at least a year swallowing every crumb of manure that they ladle down your throat on that job so that you can keep it while saving every effing penny you can for your migration. Depending on where you want to settle in the homeland, you will need at least $3,000 and a functioning automobile. You can do it for less than that, two at the least, but I would frankly recommend three. Now, by functioning automobile, I mean a car or a truck that starts when you turn the key, gets you where you want to go, and does not roll up here burning oil and needing $1,000 worth of parts and labor first thing. Which is how I rolled up when I came out here the first time in 1994. I mentioned that it doesn't seem college is an option for you, Noah, but surely somewhere in the Roseville or Sacramento area, there's some kind of technical school or community college where you can actually learn a trade, a marketable skill of some kind, so that you don't rock up here with nothing but the t-shirt on your back, expecting to flip burgers and compete with the niggers and the Mexicans economically, which white people really can't do in the cheap labor field. Or, there are a number of such schools here in the Northwest homeland, Noah, where you can learn such marketable skills. Now, as to the military, if you do decide to go into the Imperial Service, a few words of advice. First off, for God's sake, not the Army. You will find yourself thrown into a barracks for basic training with nigger and Mexican gangbangers, drug addicts, sexual perverts, and now open bugger boys. And every kind of criminal known to American society, with literal morons whose intelligence scores have been fiddled by recruiters desperate to fill their quotas. The junior officers in the Army are now almost completely appointed on political and racial and gender considerations. You will be a racial and probably a sexual minority surrounded by predatory niggers and butt rapists, and it will be the most miserable experience you have ever had in your life, not to mention the risk of getting sent to Afghanistan or Iran or the Crimea and coming back mangled and missing an arm or a leg. Now, the Marines are better, discipline and quality-wise, but the crap you see about them on the TV is at least somewhat true. Why would you want to let yourself be brainwashed into becoming a buzz-cut robot that a third-world tyrant like Obama can point, click, and kill like he was playing a video game? No paycheck is worth your soul, Noah. Now, if you absolutely must go into the service, at least use it to learn a trade, a marketable skill. That's what I beg and plead with all young white people to get. And for that purpose, the Navy is somewhat better than the Army, although I understand the Navy has gone really feminist in the past few years, and now they've jettisoned the last rules against perversion. Life on shipboard is going to be something best left to the imagination. Winston Churchill once said that the British naval tradition was, and I quote, "rum, buggery, and the lash." Is that how you want to spend the next 4 or 5 years, Noah? Because I don't think the Navy even has 3-year enlistments. That may have changed since I was around, but you might want to check that out. Anyway, if you absolutely must serve the evil empire, Noah, bust your butt to get into the Air Force. The personnel are way whiter because the entrance standards haven't been thrown into the garbage like they have in the Army. Living conditions are better, the work and the technical training is better, and everybody says the Air Force is a little more laid back than the other branches. Not nearly so much buzz-cut Mickey Mouse. That's the impression I always got anyway. Some of the Air Force vets out there may disagree with me. Best of all, in my opinion, is the Coast Guard. We had a Coast Guard station in Astoria, and I never saw one nigger and only a single Asian in Coast Guard uniform during all the time I was there. But if you want to show yourself a truly disciplined political soldier, Noah, what you need to do is work your ass off at that minimum wage job, save up 3 or 4 grand, and then get your ass up here and start making yourself a proper home in the homeland. Like this next comrade did. Now, this is a new migrant from Idaho who decided to share his migration experience with us, like I asked you to a few weeks ago. I won't give his name here just to be on the safe side, and I won't assign him a nickname since I might pick something he didn't like, so we'll just call him the new guy in Idaho. Like the new guy in Pugetopolis last week, he made this recording on an iPhone or something of the kind in his truck on his way to work at his new homeland job, so I guess that proves it can be done.
Greetings from home, comrades. I made it home. Packed the moving van and now I'm here, and I'm going to give you a little bit of a story about how I did it and about the things I had to take into consideration whenever I was making the plan so that I could make sure everything went smoothly and that I was able to get here without a hitch. So if you listen closely, you might hear the sound of engines. That's because I'm commuting. I work a lot. I always have worked a lot, and I always most likely will continue to work a lot, and I like to be efficient. I have a number of rules I put into place to get shit done, and I realize I have a lot of time on my hands on my drive to work, and I have pretty light traffic, and I'm able to think a lot about a lot of things. And so I thought, you know, I spend an hour or so listening to Radio Free Northwest with Harold Covington, also known as Howard Covington by some. So this is my opportunity to get shit done while getting to work. So how did I do it? Well, I made a scouting trip last summer. I plotted, used Google to be my friend, or as my friend, help me out. I had a number of considerations in mind, checkboxes that were important to me and my family. Primarily, I didn't want to live anywhere near an urban center. I've lived in urban centers for the latter half of my life as I was working my way through the ranks of my particular career. And in my particular career, it's nearly impossible to be accepted, respected, and to get things done unless you're in one of the premier centers across the world. And so I, earlier in my life, considered those to be high priorities. I made those top priorities that I was focusing on. More recently, what's important to me is to have a place for my kids to grow up in a safe, sound environment where I can make a living, and at the same time where I can spend time with them in rural outdoors, see forests, trees, wildlife, nature. It's a lot more important to me these days. So that was a high priority, and I plotted a few places on the map that would meet those criteria. I went out and made a scouting trip to see what it was like in real life, because you'll never actually be quite prepared for reality until you experience reality firsthand. So made a scouting trip in the summertime. After getting fed up with a number of different parts of my previous career, my previous lifestyle, basically stopped everything, threw everything in the car, plotted a course across the country with some tents and sleeping bags, and for a couple of weeks just went across the country. I had the luxury of having a lot of flexibility in my schedule, so I used it. Stopped off at state parks, national parks across the country on the way. Sometimes you typically pay $20, $25. Occasionally you'll have to pay $35, $40 for a night. Many places you can sleep where you don't have to pay anything for camping. And a lot of beautiful places across the United States to go camping. So I did that. Simultaneously, concurrently, I was scouring the internet on Craigslist and other employment opportunities, websites related to my particular career. I can tell you, in the Pacific Northwest, in rural areas, there are not a lot of high-tech, high-level business opportunities unless you are the bootstrap kind of a person that already has some investment capital and can take advantage of opportunities yourself. And I think that is primarily what one ought to try to eventually have as a focus, is something where you're in charge and you can therefore specifically align your expertise with whatever it is that you want to make money at, because that's how you make money, is to be the best and most knowledgeable and most industrious at whatever it is that you know about. However, if you don't have the capital lined up and you want to work for someone else, then it's very important that whatever your criteria are aligned with the needs of someone else. So I can tell you up here in rural areas of Pacific Northwest, there is a need for people to do very basic things like sit on a tractor or pull logs out of a forest or saw the logs into pieces or cruise forests and look for or mark trees that need to be cut down and what the length of those trees are and what species they are and how valuable they are. Anything to do with the timber industry, fishing, farming, there's a lot of that, but you also have to understand that there are people that have lived here for quite some time, quite a long time, and have built relationships, and those relationships are what are going to drive the employment opportunities in most parts unless you have a lot of experience and references, etc., to do particular things. And that's just the reality of the situation. That's the reason you have to plan ahead and to give yourself a foundation that will give you the opportunity to compete for some of those. I myself have spent my whole life devoted to a particular area of science, and I had very little problem after I started sending out my resume from the time I started getting a lot of phone calls. And within probably about 2 months, I lined up some interviews. Within 3 to 4 months, the deals were done. I had landed what I needed to in terms of employment. That would allow me to check off the boxes, live in a rural setting, and still be able to provide for my family in a confident, solid way. So that's how I did it. You might ask, what were the driving factors? Well, I told you before, there's frustration with my previous employment. My previous employment was linked in many ways to the whims of the federal government and its management or mismanagement. And I got frustrated with that. I hated that diversity was being shoved down my throat all the time, and it pushed aside excellence as a driving factor for what we were doing. And in many cases, it was quite clear to me, based on my field, that there were intelligence differences between the races or between those of different genetic ancestry. And therefore, I wasn't going to pay the diversity price. I was going to put excellence ahead. And my notion was that excellence as a driver would make my work shine in the end. And it did shine. However, the powers that be were always taking away my financial means to get things done, even in the face of the excellence that I was delivering. And so that's frustrating to have that happen over and over again, where you know you're the best, you're the brightest, you're the most productive, but you continue to be put second, third in line in situations that put others in the limelight and put others' work ahead of your own, and for obvious reasons that have very little to do with excellence. So I hope that gives a bit of insight into my line of thinking and what went into my decision-making and coming to the Pacific Northwest. I, all of my life, have been aware of the differences in genetics and how it plays into human character, how it plays into the propensity of individuals to excel in different parts of life or to be involved in criminal activity and the inability to control one's emotions and one's action. I think Harold has spent a lot of time drafting a very comprehensive plan, one of the most comprehensive plans that I've observed, and I've read a lot of different plans, and there are different stages of this thing, white nationalism, and different parts of the trees that have been gone down, or roads that have been gone down, and many have led to dead ends, because at some point it starts out with organization. Let's all get on the same page and let's all meet up and be a sounding board for each other. And then after that you say, all right, we're a sounding board. We're basically going to church with each other and singing songs that make us feel good. Now what? Once you're shit on continuously by the higher powers that govern you, you realize that meeting up and discussing how much suffering you are feeling in the face of this still isn't cutting it. You need to do a little bit more. You actually need to have some governance structure to push things forward. So I won't talk any more today. My commute is coming to an end. but I'll check back in the future. It's great to be here. I wish more like-minded individuals were here to further the planning process and to further the process of establishing a homeland for our white children and establish a governance structure that will allow that to continue on for the foreseeable or even unforeseeable future.
Okay, the RFN Rock and Roll Lobby has been really active over the past few weeks. So here is what I think is a German group called Lancer. The song is called Rebel.
I was a rebel in the Highland Freedom Wars. I fought by William Wallace from victory to victory. I did not break as they tortured me to death. I was a rebel, for freedom through my blood. I was a sergeant under General Lee. In the old South Gray Cavalry. In the swamps of the South, my spirit still glows. I was a rebel, for freedom through my blood. I was a werewolf in the shadows of the same. In the last days of our glorious reign, you with the white flag upon your hat. Here comes a rebel, and I will spill your blood. I was a defender in the east of the Ukraine. We made the Red Army running far, far away. A race before hate with unconscious fury. I was a rebel, for freedom through my blood. On the morning of glory, on June 17th, against Soviet tanks and political police, that Molotov cocktail, it burnt so good. I was a rebel, for freedom through my blood. I am a rebel, and forever I'll remain.
On this podcast, I will explain my analysis of what it will take to make National Socialism successful in America. The first thing that has to take place is that the American worker has to figure out that the Communist Party, or in America's case, the Democrats, are a fraud. That in no way, shape, or form do the Democrats have any intention of ever properly representing the American workers. Now let us take a look at Germany. In 1848, Karl Marx published the Communist Manifesto. However, Great Britain was still a country ruled by the aristocracy. Britain did not become a democracy until 1855 with the Chartists, so that back in 1848, Britain was still politically backward, and America had yet to fight the Civil War. The formation of an independent Labour Party in Germany took about 70 years. From 1848 to 1920 is about 70 years. So now, if it takes the American worker the same amount of time to come to the same conclusion, at what point did the Democratic Party become the Party of Labour? Now, if Americans are more retarded than Germans, it will take longer for the American worker to conclude that the Democrats are a fraud. Voting for the Republicans is a waste of time. They will never represent the workers. Once the American worker has concluded that the Democratic Party is a fraud, then he will be ready to vote for a different Labour Party. Are there enough American workers who are so fed up with the Democratic fraud that they will vote for an American Labour Party? Shall we call Obama Rosa Luxemburg? Entryism into the Republican Party, in my opinion, will never work. They want cheap labour. In my opinion, the Conservatives will vote for cheap labour even if it leads to their complete destruction. You only have to look at South Africa to see where the priorities of Conservatives lie. The survival of South Africa came second to making money. They abandoned South Africa in preference to lifting the embargo. A Conservative will stuff his money into a Swiss bank account and leave the country before he becomes a patriot. For example, George Bush is buying land in Paraguay. How much money has Obama stuffed into a Swiss bank account? I bet you he is a traitor and has stuffed taxpayers' money into a Swiss bank account. In fact, the Catholic Church has got it right. Priests have to take a vow of poverty. We have allowed politicians to become wealthy at taxpayers' expense. In future, all who claim that they will serve the public will have to take a vow of poverty. Taxation is a form of armed robbery, and all politicians who use that money for their own benefit are no better than armed robbers. The Jewish bitch, known as the Queen of Mean, said it best. Only the little guy pays taxes. The tax system has been rigged so that the rich pay no taxes. So are you ready to start an American Labour Party? Hitler was member number 7 of the German Labour Party. Will the American worker be ready to vote for an American Labour Party when the dollar crashes and we have hyperinflation, just like the Weimar Republic? Quantitative easing is just a fancy way of creating inflation without calling it inflation. So what should the manifesto of the American Labour Party be? Well, the first part of the manifesto is secession from the Union. The saying is, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. We cannot hope to change Washington, D.C. It is far too corrupt. Secession is something we can achieve. We cannot hope to reform the FBI or any other alphabet agency. We cannot hope to have control over the Federal Reserve, but by means of secession, we can have sound money. We cannot hope for a proper investigation of 9/11. We have waited long enough. Our patience is at an end. It is time for the creation of the American Labour Party.
On Saturday, March 15th, one of the other racial podcasts called for a million white men march all across the country, which would have been a great idea if we could have found the million white men somewhere. I have no idea what, if anything, actually happened. If anything made the news, I didn't see it. Now, I'm not sure whose idea this was or how it came about, but I believe it had something to do with Horace the Avenger and the White Rabbit podcast. I actually didn't hear about it until the day before it was supposed to happen, when all of a sudden an individual on Facebook who decided he wanted to participate started demanding that Andy Donner and myself do so as well, and that we bring with us that huge secret NVA Panzer Division we've got hidden up here in the North Woods. Now, you know about the secret army we've got hidden out in the woods, don't you? We're so good at hiding it, the FBI can't even find it. I know, because they keep wandering around the Pacific Northwest, knocking on people's doors, looking for someone who will tell them where our secret army is. Tell you what, I'll give you FBI guys a hint. Go up to Montana and start digging in the ground. I think some of Starship Ruthie's diehard followers may still be living in underground bunkers waiting for the mothership. Where was I? Oh, yeah. When Andy and I politely declined to go for a stroll on Saturday, this guy started ranting and raving the usual spritz about how we were quote-unquote cowards who hide in our basement because we won't go out and hold a piece of canvas over a bridge. A piece of canvas, incidentally, bearing someone else's mantra and someone else's group name, by the way, as part of a group of 6 or 8 people. That's something I've noticed. Attendance at these things is now virtually non-existent. 20 years ago, with a little advanced preparation like the Pulaski, Tennessee March every January, we could bring out between 300 and 400 bodies. 10 years ago, after Billy Roper had quit giving away the free beer at his skinhead events due to problems with underage drinking, it was down to about 40 people, max. The same old faces, the middle-aged and elderly people who would drive all night to get to one of these things. These days, we're down to 8 or 10 bodies on a really good day. Everybody seems to have pretty much gotten the message on the streetwalking thing. Nobody really goes to them anymore. Although, whether that's because we've finally figured out it doesn't work, or whether it's because the internet is now satisfying whatever psychological need we feel to convince ourselves that we're really not the weak and soft and timid and frightened people we are, I couldn't tell you. In a way, this guy on Facebook was right. The overwhelming majority of our community exists solely on the internet, and in the real world we are indeed cowards in a sense, just not for the reason he was saying. It is not cowardly to avoid making a fool of yourself in public and maybe getting yourself seriously jammed up to no purpose when the police or assorted local idiots get your name and find out where you live and where you work, all the while accomplishing absolutely nothing for the 14 words of the Northwest Republic. There is a difference between courage and pointless silliness, and it is childish to give in to name-calling and allow yourself to be pressurized into doing things that you know perfectly well to be tactically useless and strategically wrong, as most of us are by now aware that streetwalking is, at least not until such time as we can actually get large numbers of people to show up, or hell, until we can get anybody to show up. It most certainly is cowardly, or at least negligent in a form of moral turpitude, to refuse to make TLC, Total Life Commitment, to the Northwest Republic, and to not spend every waking hour devoted to bringing that republic into existence. Look, I was tempted to go back down memory lane and pull out my article from 12 years ago called The Streetwalking Rationale, which is one of the most famous I ever wrote, if I do say so myself, and which is just as pertinent and topical today as it was all those years ago, because the same question is confronting us. When are we going to learn to stop doing this nonsense? When are we going to learn that it doesn't work? But I am sure most of you are familiar with that article, so I won't bore you with a long reading of it. If there's anyone out there who hasn't read it and is curious, email me at nwnet@earthlink.net, and I'll send you a copy. There is one absolutely overwhelming objection against streetwalking as a tactic. It doesn't work. It hasn't worked for 50 years. Now, I explain why not in the article. It has never worked, either for us or for the hippy-dippies, and they can get hundreds of thousands of people to come out. This society is structured and conditioned to ignore people running around in the streets. Hell, during the Vietnam War, they got 500,000 people choking Washington, D.C. during the 1969 moratorium demonstration against the war, and Nixon just ignored the hippy-dippies. As I recall, he wasn't even in town that weekend. He was sipping bourbon by the indoor pool at Camp David, and I'm doing it again, aren't I? Sorry. Okay, back to the streetwalking thing. Let me spell this out for you guys once again. Don't worry, I'll keep on doing that until you can get your arms around it. Now, you people have been taught all your lives to feel and not to think, so I know these things can take a while. If you want to streetwalk, run around in public with a sign or wearing a strange costume, hey, whatever floats your boat. Knock yourself out. If you keep it up, eventually bad things are going to happen to you because you've given the enemy a visible target, and they don't have too many of those, which is one reason why they're constantly making things up. But I have come to accept that for whatever reason, I cannot convey to you much of the 42 years of experience I have in these matters. I tell you these things, and it just goes in one ear and out the other, and I know how that sounds, but no, I'm not angry or bitter. I've gone through all the stages, and I've reached acceptance now. For whatever reason, this is one area where I just can't seem to get through, and I need to quit beating myself to death over it. It looks like everybody's got to go through their own learning curve on this. The same learning curve I did.
So, Harold, if we don't stand around on the street corner holding a sign and letting cops and idiots take our picture, then tell us, oh mighty one, what do we do?
I'll save you the trouble of sending me all the emails on that one. Look, in point of fact, I have already told you what to do. In some detail, in fact. It's in the 5th edition of the Northwest Front Party Manual, called the White Book. I have posted the link so you can order the book on the Thought Crime blog, but if you'll contact me, I will send you that link, and if you're too cheap to spend $10.28 for a copy, I will happily send you a free copy in PDF format. In that manual, I tell you exactly what you should be doing and how to do it. So, enjoy.
Good afternoon, comrades. I'm Olivia from Seattle, and I've been helping Harold with some of the correspondence lately. One of the topics that came up in response to an article piqued my interest. It was a minor tirade on the kosher tax we all pay on the majority of the food we buy in the grocery store. I've known about the kosher tax for a while now, although I didn't research it very thoroughly when I heard about it because I had other issues that were more pressing, such as contacting the Northwest Front to begin actively promoting survival of our race. Anyway, this tirade made the point that the kosher tax is, in effect, a religious fee, and by requiring non-Jews to pay this fee to have food certified to Jewish religious specifications, our rights to freedom of religion are being violated. While I had thought many things about this tax, that was not one of them, but it is a valid point. Even if I believed in eating in accordance with true biblical restrictions on what constitutes food, as identified by many Christian identity practitioners and outlined in portions of the Old Testament, which I don't, by the way, those restrictions relate to animals only and have nothing to do with pasta, canned fruits and vegetables, wine, crackers, and the plethora of other foods that are kosher certified today. Not to mention things like cleaning products, aluminum foil, and even steel. Come on, who eats steel? So what is the tax, and why are we paying it? Well, as mentioned earlier, it is, in effect, a religious fee, one that non-Jews pay for being non-Jews. If you do a search on Google, you'll be presented with many websites, including Snopes.com, where they state that while the cost of the certification is added to the price of the product, it is such a minuscule amount, especially compared to the cost of advertising, shipping, packaging, etc., it makes as much sense to rail against the cost of the ink colors used on the packaging itself as it does to protest the kosher tax. However, if you do further research, you'll find that the minuscule sum received by the Orthodox Union, the capital letter U in a circle, amounted to roughly $20 million in 2005. Yes, that's right, I said $20 million. And that's just for 1 year! According to the Albuquerque Tribune, on July 29, 2002, the costs for kosher certification are approximately $6 billion per year, or about $1 for every $30 spent on kosher-certified products, which is passed on to the consumer as the kosher tax. Given the fact that Jews amount to, at most, 2% of the population, non-Jews are paying at least 98% of the cost for kosher certification, something we care nothing about. Like so many things related to Jews, Non-Jews are unknowingly footing the bill for them, since the vast majority have no idea what those small symbols on their food mean, if they even notice them at all, given the fact that they are placed on the packaging in a manner that draws little attention, unless you're specifically looking for them. The majority of those few who do notice and do know what it all means would never dream of saying anything for fear of being called an anti-Semite. And so the vicious cycle is perpetuated. Jews take advantage of whites, and whites don't say anything, so we slide slow inch by slow inch deeper into the muck. What boggles my mind is that there are some Jew-aware white men who actually promote buying kosher food, saying that it's safer, that the kosher process is used to provide safe food for Jewish people, while the same foods in non-kosher form contain chemicals and additives not found in their kosher counterparts. All it takes is a few seconds of perusing labels to realize that while there may be a few minor differences in the unpronounceable ingredients, kosher products still contain neurotoxins such as MSG, high fructose corn syrup, and all the other noxious ingredients greedy big business uses to pollute our food supply. To say kosher food is in some way better for you is irresponsible and puts more money in Jewish pockets to the detriment of our race. It makes one wonder whose pockets these men are in. It's gotten to the point where it's hard to find food in the grocery stores that isn't kosher certified. But with a little work and diligence, it is possible to find most things in non-kosher form. However, much of the kosher tax can be sidestepped entirely by making it a point to avoid prepackaged foods as much as possible. This is just one more reason, comrades, why those who are not yet living here in the homeland need to get a move on. So we're ready to take advantage of the bubble when it bursts and begin the process of creating our free white homeland, where things like the Jewish kosher tax, not to mention Jews themselves, no longer exist.
This is a kind of a new agey group called Wild Oats. They're pretty obviously a bunch of aging hippies who think they're Pentangle, and this isn't a real song about Robin Hood, but it's got a nice medieval sound to it, and it's not bad.
Three kingsmen rode in the bonny green wood, and we thought them three too many, oh, so we shot them down and stripped their pockets of every silver penny, oh. Three kingsmen were a meager hunt, in a week's time we had plenty, oh. 100 soldiers came to call, and we were but 24, oh. The crown be damned, and the throne be damned, and damn him who sits there. My heart belongs to a finer king who rides in Outremer. The winter it comes fierce and lean, and it struck the house of Willie, oh. He shot down one of the king's own deer to fill six empty bellies, oh. The king's men would have hanged him high, but we rode in wild and angry, oh. The king's deer are for the king's own sport, but the king has never gone hungry, oh. The crown be damned, and the throne be damned, and damn him who keeps them. My heart belongs to a finer king at a war in Jerusalem. Many's a house has been laid bare to fill the king's own coffers, oh. The tax they cannot pay in gold, they pay in land and daughters, oh. One lass of a fallen house was sold to a lord in the king's high favor, oh. We stormed the kirk with fire and steel from a loveless bed to save her, oh. Damn the false prince on the throne and the royal mess he's made. My heart belongs to a finer king who rides on the high crusade. The crown be damned, and the throne be damned, and damn him who sits there. My heart belongs to a finer king who rides in Outremer.
Okay, since I seem to be doing a lot of spaced repetition this week, I think I'll take another stab at a subject which is arguably the most important of all that we have to deal with. Now, this is one of those things that somehow I have to get through to you people on, because it involves something that you, and only you, can do. No way I can do it for you. It's logistically impossible, and until you start holding up your end and doing this, we go nowhere. Let me ask you something. Why is it that 12 years after my own homecoming, the Northwest Independence Movement is still so tiny? Is it because I haven't mounted my white horse and drawn my saber and blown my bugle and yelled, "Charge!" like Teddy in Arsenic and Old Lace? Now, in a sense, yes, but let's just be clear on this. It's not that I don't want to lead the charge. Show me at least a 51% chance of winning and I'll do it. But before that can happen, you guys have to give me the horse, the saber, and the bugle. And then you have to stand behind me where I can turn around and look back and see your faces and not a bunch of computer terminals. Where are all the people who need to step forward and start giving me what I need to be a comic opera-style fearless leader, since that seems to be what you want? It's not just a spectator sport, you know. In order for me to give you the show you want, I need money and I need physical bodies. Where are they? Why is it that 5 years after putting up not one but two brilliant, attractive professional websites and one blog that's not half bad if I do say so myself, our weekly visitors to those sites are still numbered in four figures? We have the greatest idea in human history. White people the world over should be battering our doors down to get it. So, where the hell is everybody? We were talking a few minutes ago about the fact that our wee little movement is lucky to get 8 or 10 people to turn out for a street activity, down from the 300 or 400 that we could get with a little planning 20 years ago. 300 or 400 people. For us, that would be an incredible accomplishment today. But even back then, it was no larger than a fairly well-attended wedding reception or a chiropractor's convention in the local Holiday Inn. You know how long it's been since any white racial event could be measured in the thousands? I'll tell you, 1987 in Forsyth County, Georgia, and that was for only a few days, as the people there tried to repel a physical invasion of niggers. Before that, it was only once before, 1966, in Chicago under Commander Rockwell. Same situation, niggers were literally coming across Western Avenue to seize white people's houses. And now, we have easily less than 10,000 people total who will even speak up for the white race on the nice, safe internet. And even then, all but a handful of them conceal their identities online, or they think they do. Only a couple of hundred at any given time even dare to post to Stormfront or VNN. We have truth and justice and natural law on our side. And with those things and $1.50, we can buy a small cup of watery coffee at McDonald's. I might add that one of the reasons we've taken to hanging banners on the rails of highway overpasses is that even the few remaining people among us who do streetwalk have finally come to understand that a so-called rally with 8 people looks absurd and makes us look weak and contemptible. Those nice big banners hanging from the bridges to some degree camouflage our tiny numbers. But why are there so few of us? Is it because we really are some tiny nutty minority like the liberal media portray us? I think we all know that's not true, and that's what makes this so incredibly frustrating. As it happens, we are right. God damn it all, we are right. And there are tens of millions of white people in this country who know instinctively that we are right. They may not be able to articulate what they're seeing and feeling because the public schools and the media have denied them the use of the necessary language to do so. But we can articulate what they see and know, and if we can ever get them to hear us, they will love us for it. They will finance a proper independence movement, and one day we will be able to call a street walk and get tens of thousands of people to march. If they are ever allowed to hear us. There are tens of millions of white people in this country. White people who agree with the overwhelming majority of everything we say, so long as it is presented to them carefully, coherently, and gently, without immediately confronting them with symbols and terminology that they've been conditioned from birth to reject, which is why we avoid the use of things like the swastika and the letters KKK, even though both of those are proud and noble traditions for our people. Just because something happens to be true and right, still, it may not be the best idea to try and drive it into people's head with a hammer. One has to slip the truth into a white mind slowly, gradually, deftly, being careful not to trip the rejection mechanisms that America had built into that mind to make it slam shut at the first whiff of racial truth. But where are those tens of millions of white people who agree with us? Why can't we get them to come into the streets en masse like the niggers and the hippy-dippy bird brains have been doing for the past 50 years? Is it because white people have become total herd animals and they are incapable of thinking, only feeling? Yes, to a large extent that's true, but there are still enough exceptions to that so that we ought to at least be able to get a few thousand of those exceptions to come out for a rally or a demonstration. Is it because white people are totally materialistic and are utterly terrified of losing what little they still have of material goods and wealth? Yes, to some extent that's why. But as the Obama Depression lengthens and deepens, fewer and fewer white people have anything left to lose. They've been foreclosed, they've lost their jobs, they're living in Section 8 housing on food stamps, and they are smart enough to understand that there is no longer any hope for white people in Obama's America. And since they've been conditioned all their lives to believe in democracy and taught that the way one protests against mistreatment by the government is to waddle down the street holding a sign, you'd think that there would be countless thousands of people in areas like Seattle and Portland and all across the homeland who would be chomping at the bit to get out there and walk down the street showing their butts like the hippy-dippies and the illegal immigrants do all the time. So, where are they? Why can't we bring them out into the streets, these millions of white people who agree with us? And yes, they most certainly do exist. The answer is very simple and enraging. All these millions of white people just plain do not know that we are here. We are completely blacked out by the establishment media, and I can't get enough of you guys to proselytize for the Northwest Republic on the internet, which is the one major medium of communication we have. No one has forced the link to www.northwestfront.org under those people's noses again and again until finally, out of sheer curiosity, they clicked on it just to see what all the fuss was about. No one has sat down with them in the break room at work and pressed a copy of The Brigade into their hands and said, "Look, Joe, I know it's a big, thick book, and you probably haven't even tried to read a book since high school, but please, trust me on this. You need to make the effort here, if only for your children's sake. You need to read this book. Here's a copy, and I'm not taking no for an answer." That's the kind of personal missionary work that all of you should be doing. Instead, you're just logging off this show every week and waiting until the next week for your next dose of entertainment. The hardest part of our revolution, of course, is when we will have to break brave to confront the United States and its armed men and make our country a reality. But in one sense, the truly hardest part is over now because we know what we're going to do. At long last, we have our plan, the Northwest Front. No one else, not some neo-national alliance blog that drivels on and on and on year after year with intellectual twaddle posted by aging men who don't even dare use their real names. The Northwest Imperative is it, people. That's our solution. We are going to create a sovereign and independent homeland for all the white people of the world right here in the Pacific Northwest. But before we can begin to convey the idea of Northwest independence and teach our own people about David Lane and the 14 words, we have to break the media blackout on our very existence. How many times per week do you get on your computer and post the link to northwestfront.org in places where it can be seen by white people, especially young white people? How many times per week do you sit down with a friend or coworker or relative and talk race and political truth? As you slowly prepare them for the solution, Northwest independence. Now, the fifth edition of the White Book states that every Northwest nationalist needs to be working at least three or four personal contacts at all times. How many personal contacts are you working one-on-one, face-to-face? Because that's how it's supposed to be done. The party shouldn't actually have to do much in the way of background checking on new prospects, because the man on the ground, you, should have done all the character vetting beforehand. Do me a favor, will you guys? Stop sending me emails and letters telling me all about what I need to be doing and how I need to do it to suit your fancy, and start sending me emails and letters telling me, "Hey, Harold, this week I did so-and-so and thus-and-such." Knife posting the link to northwestfront.org. Is all that you know in your heart you can or will do, then so be it. It's a minor thing, but oddly enough, it's possibly the most important thing anyone can do if you do it enough. Just make sure that you post it. Try for a minimum of 100 postings a week. Anywhere and everywhere a white person might see it and be curious enough to click on it. Especially a young white person. Okay, running long, and so it's time for third music break. Now, some of you may remember a song I mentioned in my novel, The Stars in Their Path. It's one of the oldest of Irish folk songs, called She Moved Through the Fair. This is David Byrne. A couple of weeks ago, I discussed the possibility of reviving our old email contact list that I used to send out some years ago on a regular basis. This was a list wherein racially conscious white people, who were living in a state of almost complete isolation, as most of us do, would list their email addresses and seek contacts with other white nationalists in their area, preferably within half an hour's drive, with a view towards taking the first step off the internet and back into the real physical world through face-to-face meeting. Now, we sent out that old list for several years, and while we had some people who basically just wanted to use it as a place to play, which is entirely to be expected in our wee little subculture, we also did have a few productive meetings between white people arranged through it, so I suppose you might say the results were mixed. Then the inevitable happened, and we had a couple of incidents of sketchy people seriously abusing the list. Again, not an unexpected development, and I shut it down for almost 2 years. I've been getting a lot of people begging me for local contacts in their areas to the point where I opened the subject of re-establishing the email list, and after a lot of discussion I did about 10 days ago. So far, out of approximately 2,000 email contacts that the party itself maintains and occasionally uses on various lists, including our main list, which is called Northwest Revolution, we have had all of 30 people step forward and offer to publish their email addresses so that they can physically meet other white nationalists, many for the first time. Almost none of the people who have been pestering me for months, wanting me to introduce them to people in the area, volunteered. Yet again, not too surprising a development for our little slice of life here. Now, I should mention that the old list, at its height, never got much larger than about 150 names, as I recall, and that was out of a much larger series of bulk lists, which I maintained at the time, so it's not as if this was ever a major participatory activity. Now, to me, the thousands of white people who are still too terrified to take even this one itsy-bitsy little baby step out from behind the computer are a stark reminder of just how little we've come along the path to where we have to be, and how far we have left to go. Now, from now on, I will maintain the list and send it out periodically when we do have any new people who are willing to participate, but here's one more potentially useful and maybe even crucial tool that we aren't making any use of because of our rabbit's courage. There is nothing illegal about this. Yes, it's true that the FBI and the NSA will probably take note of your email address, which is one reason why I demand that you use a separate address and nothing that contains your actual name. But after the Edward Snowden affair, surely there's no one out there who's foolish enough to think that the regime doesn't know who you are and where you live. I never cease to be amazed at our apparently infinite capacity for self-delusion. Now, I don't know what to tell you guys, except that if our race cannot find at least a small handful of people who are willing to place their duty and their honor higher than their fear and their own personal welfare, then we're just not going to exist in another 100 years. The last elderly white man or woman will probably die up around the Arctic Circle someplace, some little godforsaken village in Canada or maybe in Russia, sometime around the year 2114. Or maybe the Chinese will actually keep a few breeding pairs of us alive in zoos. Who knows? Anyway, our time is up, so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.